From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners. We're very thankful for every listener we have. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, March 1st marks the end of the Baha'i intercalary days, but at sundown, the Baha'i 19-day fast begins. The first is also Orthodox Christian Sunday. The Jewish observance of Purim starts at sundown on March 4th. Thursday is Magha Puja Day for Buddhists, and on Friday, Hindus observe Holi, while Sikhs mark Hola Mahala. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief Radio.
Last week, Travis County clerks issued the first state license to a gay couple, Sarah Goodfriend and Suzanne Bryant.
Today, Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton moved to invalidate the marriage license issued to a same-sex couple yesterday in Travis County. Paxton told justices that legal chaos could erupt if the state's high court does not strike down the marriage license.
You've probably seen the headlines. Earlier this month, a judge in Texas allowed a longtime lesbian couple to marry in Austin, Texas, the capital. There's an ongoing legal tug of war over marriage in that state, but this was treated as an exceptional case since one of the partners is battling cancer. But that hasn't stopped Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton from demanding that the marriage be nullified. On this week's show, I'll talk with the brides ensnared in this scandalous attempt to erase from history the first and so far only legal same-gender wedding in the Lone Star State. I'll be joined by Sarah Goodfriend and Suzanne Bryant.
I may have the genetic coding that I'm inclined to be an alcoholic, but I have the desire not to do that, and I look at the homosexual issue as the same way.
And I don't think the law should be forcing Americans to violate their religious faith.
The law is made to regulate murderers and manslayers, who murders of mothers, murders of fathers, fornicators, homosexuals.
I agree with Moses and Jesus that marriage was a man and a woman. People like me are considered haters, hate mongers, which really is exactly what we've seen going back to the days of the Nazi takeover in Europe.
Texas has spawned some of the most radically right-wing theocratic leaders our nation has ever seen. For them, rabid anti-Muslim, anti-gay, anti-you-and-me rhetoric in the name of a God they alone seem to have direct instruction from bleeds seamlessly from pulpit to state house and back again. At the same time, a significant number of progressive faith leaders have become increasingly vocal in opposing bigotry, homophobia, and hate in Texas, and a good deal of the organizing credit goes to the nonprofit Equality Texas. This week, you'll meet that organization's Todd Whitley. But first,
Jesus of Nazareth, you are charged with blasphemy.
Where did you see him?
In heaven.
It's not going to get easier, period. And so the church is going to have to navigate some very, very difficult waters here in America.
The past year has been marked by an unusually large number of Christian-themed films. While you wouldn't know it from the Academy Awards, large audiences were reached through new and innovative methods, including subscription viewings and even church screenings. But there are other subgenres that are thriving, as evidenced, for example, by the broad offerings at this year's Washington Jewish Film Festival, which is wrapping up this weekend. Among the filmmakers represented was award-winning writer, director, and producer Aviva Kempner, who actually founded the festival itself in 1989. For a look at the power and potential of this kind of focus within the film world, I am honored and pleased to be joined now by Aviva Kempner. Aviva, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Oh, thanks so much for your interest.
You're latest film, The Rosenwald Schools, premiered at the Washington Jewish Film Festival this week. Talk about what drew you to this story.
I decided in 79, after I didn't pass the bar, that I should go become a filmmaker. And as a child of a Holocaust survivor, I really wanted to deal with an issue about the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. So the first film I made was Partisans of Vilna, about Jews fighting Nazis. And then I decided that I should continue my trek of doing non-stereotypical films about Jews. And at that point, there were just a couple Jewish film festivals. And then I decided to launch one in my own community, Washington, D.C. So we created it 25 years ago, and I then made a film about a Jewish baseball player, Hank Greenberg. Mm-hmm. And then I made a whole film about someone who had a famous radio and then TV show, Gertrude Berg and the Goldbergs. Mm-hmm. My latest film is something probably the most underknown Jewish heroes, and that's Julius Rosenwald, who's the head of Sears and Roebuck. We all know about Sears and Roebuck today. Mm-hmm. But 100 years ago, he had a calling, literally. He had a rabbi named Emil Hirsch, who from the pulpit would argue, we have to repair the world. There's a principle in Judaism, tikkun olam. And he inspired Julius Rosenwald to help. So he built Black Y's all over the States. He did something in Chicago. And then he partnered with Booker T. Washington at Tuskegee. And they built over 5,000 schools for African-American youth during the Jim Crow years. And oftentimes they were built as property donated by a black church and by the black church. And then later on, he also developed a fund that supported people like Gordon Parks, Jacob Lawrence, and the great singer Marianne Anderson. So it's very much a film about philanthropy and giving, that when you really can make a lot of money or even a little money, mm-hmm. that you should give to your community or give to your country. So I'm very excited about that. And who knew that when I started the film festival 25 years ago and we had like 10 films, we now have like over 80 screenings. So it's quite exciting for me to see this all grow. And there's a line about you don't have to be Jewish to like rye bread. Well, you don't have to be Jewish to come to our films. My films have been all over America, and I hope this summer and fall in the South. It's called Rosenwald. You know, I just want to inspire people. And oftentimes the films here do inspire people. Mm-hmm.
I think the incredible contribution of Julius Rosenwald to African-American education will be a surprise to a lot of people. How do these stories get lost? Because Booker T. Washington is a household name.
Well, I think a couple things happened. One is it's 100 years ago. I have young associates that work with me. You know who Marian Anderson was.
Yes, right? I do.
And you know how she couldn't perform at the DAR and performed at Lincoln Memorial? I have two young associates in their 20s, very bright young women. They didn't know the story at all. And I went to dinner the other night with someone, a young African-American filmmaker. She didn't know it either. So I think a lot of it may be just education, and that's why I always do very strong DVDs. Mm-hmm. Because I think it's important to point out that our history is how you learn to go in the future. And these schools that were built were like the charter movement today. Mm-hmm. And people seeing what's around us and we got to do something. He also established the Rosenwald Fund that after 25 years would go in oblivion. It wouldn't stay like the Rockefeller Fund or the Ford Foundation. And his awards to African-American artists, and including whites too, like Woody Guthrie, were like McCarthy Genius Awards. And so if the fund goes out of existence and isn't in the news, mm-hmm. and people have died off and aren't in history, you know, in current history, then you don't know about it. But that'll change by the time the film goes all around America by the end of the year.
Absolutely.
And people can read about it on my website, rosenwaldschoolsfilm.org. Rosenwald, R-O-S-E-N-W-A-L-D, schools, plural, film.org.
Would it be fair to say that your films tend to operate on two distinct levels, with a narrative that looks honestly at lesser-known stories of Jewish experience, but also inform a broader understanding of the human experience?
Absolutely. and popular culture. I mean, you know, Hank Greenberg was as much about the golden age of baseball.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, back in those days, so baseball was just wonderful. And you, who Mrs. Goldberg, you know, radio, which was so important, and TV, and a woman conquering the industry. And now Rosenwald, you know, when one group of the population tries to put another down, what you can do and how the communities themselves worked with Rosenwald. It wasn't mm-hmm. just giving, it was they did one-third. It's absolutely, you hit it right on the nail, one of my biggest goals.
I want to talk about the Washington Jewish Film Festival. What made you feel there was a need for a specifically themed forum like this?
Well, I mean, I think it goes back to my background. I'm a child of a Holocaust survivor. There was so much hatred and destruction because of my family's religion that the only way I can counter it is to try to present the cultural positive portrayals, and maybe some there's a little negative portrayals too, but of the Jewish experience. So people say, hey, you know, we're like everyone else. We're part of the communities. We're part of history, and come learn about us. And then, it's just as you say, you can learn about the human experience. There's a new Israeli film called Get, and it's about, if you're very Orthodox in Judaism, to get a divorce, you have to go to a rabbinical court with Orthodox rabbis. And in Israel, it can sometimes be very difficult, or in general, it happens here too, where the husband can refuse to grant it, and it puts an Orthodox woman in no status at all. She can't remarry.
Hmm.
So there's a very new, powerful film about that. I think it's also very exciting that as I started to do this film festival 25 years ago, they're all over the country, and it's not just Jewish film festivals that we now have in major cities, some of which I'm approaching now, like mm-hmm. in Nashville and Durham, film festivals where often, you know, our independent documentaries can come and people can see what happened in history or another part of the world.
Mm-hmm. I also am interested in your opinion about whether or not there's a general group of subjects that you would target for more filmmakers to involve themselves in. For example, history, religious themes, something else. What would you push others to do?
You know, whenever I speak with students, I always say, at least do the oral history of your families.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's fascinating. I also have friends with different heritages. One I'm very close to who does Irish-themed films, others about the African-American experience. I just think the more that we can tell our stories and our history, the more, again, we can understand the future. I also under the belief that when you make documentaries, they shouldn't be quote-unquote boring factual.
Right.
My MO is not to use any narration. The people tell the stories and they weave them in and on. I use a lot of feature footage that shows the past. It also means I have to raise a lot of money. It's a 501c3 that makes these movies,
mm-hmm.
my movies. So mm-hmm. It takes me sometimes 13 years to make Hank, 7 years to make this film and others. So it really is a community film because I always says it takes a village. People, you know, mm-hmm. send me contributions, and that's how we make the film. And that's the way people feel, look, we've contributed to history. And I think that's another aspect of it. Just like in our festival, a lot of people contribute for the festival to happen.
Did you have a reaction to the way this year's Academy Awards played out?
I think it was a great affirmation of independent cinema.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite film, hands down, was Ida, the Polish film.
Uh-huh.
And I am absolutely thrilled it won Best Film. And it really is a film about religion. A Polish young nun who starts discovering in her past that she has Jewish blood, tries to explore that, in the end does come back. And I think it's the most exquisite film I've seen. So I'm really thrilled about that. I was a big Boyhood fan, so mm-hmm. I would have hoped that would have won. But mm-hmm. still, for us independent filmmakers, it was a real good show of voting to say, hey, the independent film, not the big Hollywood blockbuster, mm-hmm. is the film that we should award. So I was thrilled.
Aviva Kempner is an award-winning filmmaker whose latest documentary, The Rosenwald Schools, premiered at the Washington Jewish Film Festival this week. Aviva founded the festival in 1989. She's the founding director of the Cecilia Foundation, which produces and distributes films to educate the public on social issues of the past and present. Aviva, I offer my congratulations on this latest film, and I really thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
While I would never support anyone's attempts to codify any particular religion in our secular laws, there are clear provisions and a long tradition of faith-driven activism on the part of Americans who draw moral guidance from their religious backgrounds. In Texas, where culture war conflicts are as plentiful as oil, a growing movement of progressive religious leaders and faith communities is stepping up to challenge the established narrative that all religion is by definition anti-gay, anti-woman, and anti-progress. As communications manager for the nonprofit Equality Texas, Todd Whitley helped organize a recent faith advocacy day at the state capitol. And I am so pleased to have him with us now on State of Belief Radio. Todd, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be talking to you.
Would you start, please, by talking about the way progressive faith leaders have been increasingly engaged in the struggle for social justice in Texas?
I feel like the progressive faith leaders have kind of felt alone. They've been busy, they've been active, but I think they've been overrun a bit by the broader but more narrow narrative that says faith can exclude people. And I perceive them being fueled and encouraged by an increasing number of faith leaders that may call themselves progressive and may not,
mm-hmm.
who are standing up and saying, this isn't us.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a feeling of relief that more and more faith leaders across the state are standing up against a message of faith that is contrary to what the word says.
Yes. I wonder how widespread is the old misperception that religious faith equals a mandate for bigotry and exclusion?
I think it's very widespread. And I think a lot of people don't have exposure to different voices, maybe outside their own faith community or to a broader news cycle that might give them a different point of view. But I know people myself who are part of faith communities where a narrow view has made certain people, particularly gay and transgender people, feel unwelcome, and they're struggling with themselves and with their faith and their conscience. Something about those narratives don't resonate with that deep faith, with that deep belief that God loves everyone and that we are to love our neighbor as ourselves regardless of who they are. And so when they have the opportunity to hear a different perspective, when other faith leaders take a stand, when other people of faith stand up and say, you know, that's not my belief. My belief is that everyone is loved by God, regardless of who they are. I think that gives them some confidence mm-hmm. to take a journey and challenge what it is that maybe they've always been taught or what they've always thought.
Todd, as a person of faith yourself, do you find a suspicion of religion among LGBT advocates that you work
Absolutely.
With, they would have every reason to be cautious based on how religion has been misused in attacks on this group.
Yeah, absolutely. I myself have been injured by religion, and I know so many, many people, not just gay and transgender people, who've been hurt by religion. And many of us gave it up or tried to give it up. And yet it's such a part of us and who we are for many of us. And for those for whom, you know, faith was not a part of their growing up, they're definitely suspicious of it because of how they've seen it used against them. That's why last week, the Faith Advocacy Day that we had at the state capitol, you know, there were about 150 people there, at least 40 faith leaders from across the state. And in the posts on social media, I watched comment after comment of people say, wow, thank you so much for taking a stand for me. It's sad that they felt maybe surprised or that it was unusual for a person's faith to stand up and say, we need to treat everybody equally with dignity and respect. And yet, that's many people's experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, the recent headlines have been about marriage equality in Texas. How has Equality Texas participated in the struggles over this issue? That's one way, but what else is going on?
So marriage equality is important here in Texas, but it's not the only thing at all that's important. One of the things that we're seeing is a move to use religion as a way to discriminate against people. So one day in Texas, across the nation, we'll all have the right to marry the person that we love.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll be able to post those pictures on Facebook and then get fired because, you know, we're gay.
Mm-hmm.
Another very disconcerting thing for us is this notion of just outright, I don't want to call it hate, but unlove for transgender people.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people in society have had exposure to lesbian and gay people and have increased their understanding. Oh, I know someone, I have someone in my family or my friend or my coworker is gay or lesbian. They have less exposure to transgender people, and that's put them in a bit of a difficult space because it really feels like here in Texas that our transgender sisters and brothers are really facing a battle for dignity and respect.
Mm-hmm.
That the gay and lesbian are about to gain through marriage, but we're all facing this risk of legalized discrimination, and it's not just us. There's a lot of people affected by these religious exception bills that you're seeing pop up.
Yeah.
And these ugly bathroom policing policies, and they're nothing more than something that's trying to go after transgender people, and I think that's one of the most egregious things happening in our state right now.
Hmm. What kind of support are you getting at Equality Texas?
Equality Texas has always had the support of progressive people. We're really gaining support from people of faith. I think there's a lot of people that say, well, I don't know how to talk to a legislator, or I've never called a legislator before. Equality Texas exists to equip anybody in our state to be able to make a difference,
mm-hmm.
whether it's through sending an email or providing to them a layman's understanding of legislation and the impact that it can have, not just to LGBT people, but to other groups as well,
mm-hmm.
Empowering them, providing them with opportunities to show up at the Capitol and make their voice heard, and also empowering people who have that different faith view to realize that that can be an expression of their witness and their faith,
mm-hmm.
to stand up and advocate for others.
Todd, you've already told us that you were hurt by religious institutions. What caused you to jump into that fray after being hurt rather than to just throw up your hands and say, I quit and I'm going to leave it alone?
I'll tell you what, I wanted to give up on religion. And somewhere along my journey, I never gave up on God. I never gave up on the idea that I was fearfully and wonderfully made. And I began to open my mind and my heart back up to the reality that if I am fearfully and wonderfully made, so are a lot of other people that are hurting. And, you know, my mama raised me to do what's right, to follow the golden rule. And I felt like I had a responsibility to show a different way, to show that a gay man could also be a Christian. You know, we love God, many of us, and there are gay and lesbian and transgender people of all different faiths who believe in that and want to do what's right and honor the word that we believe in. And for me, it's been very healing to reclaim my faith, to reclaim the good things about my faith,
mm-hmm.
to realize that my sisters and brothers, regardless of what faith tradition they belong to, many of them came to accept me and evolve in what their understanding of loving your neighbor as yourself meant. It's a struggle because everywhere we see, it feels like we're being attacked. And yet, the same God that loves them loves us all.
Todd Whitley is Communications Manager at Equality Texas. Among the organization's broad-based advocacy for full and equal rights for all Texans is a growing engagement with diverse faith leaders who are speaking out for LGBT Texans, not despite but because of their sincerely held religious beliefs. Todd, I thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much.
Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton has only been in office since January, but he's wasted no time in making a name for himself as a defender of, I put in quotes, family values. At least that must be the way he sees himself when he heads home to his wife and four kids after a hard day at the office trying to nullify the marriage of two Texans who happen both to be women. Sarah Goodfriend and Suzanne Bryant were married by Rabbi Cary Baker in Austin on February 19th. We have to consider the individual lives and relationships impacted by this process. And so I am honored to be able to welcome Sarah Goodfriend and Suzanne Bryant to State of Belief Radio. Sarah, Suzanne, I'm very grateful to you for being willing to be with us on State of Belief.
Thank you for having us. Thanks for having us.
First of all, I want to congratulate you on your marriage after 30 years together. The first legally wed same-sex couple in Texas. And I'd like for you to talk about why it was important for you to do this now, even as many of us are holding our breath waiting for the Supreme Court.
This is Sarah. Actually, we really began actively seeking to be married about 8 years ago. But the urgency really became clear this last May when I had emergency surgery and was diagnosed with ovarian cancer.
Mm.
What led to our ability to marry was a decision in a probate case here in Austin where two women had been living together for
8 years.
One of them died of colon cancer, and her partner was put in the unfortunate position of possibly not being considered next of kin for all kinds of things. We have a homestead law here in Texas that if people are married, the partner cannot be thrown out of the home. We have, of course, issues related to medical care, burial, financial benefits, and so forth. So with my diagnosis and the kind of difficulties the couple I mentioned were facing, it became more important to us.
Mm. So that's the intensely personal dimension of this. My assumption is that both of you already have been actively involved in the whole debate about same-gender marriage and weighing in on what justice would call for.
Yes, we have. We have been realizing that it's really about the freedom to marry, and we've been watching what happens in the courts and in the hearts and minds of people all over the United States and in the hearts and minds of people in Texas, and seeing that it is a fundamental right under the U.S. Constitution to be able to get married, and it is something that if you've been together as long as we have, I don't think that we will love each other any differently, but I do think we look at our relationship now with some kind of specialness. I don't know quite what to say, but one day I thought about it, and I thought if I meet a man that I know well and love, and he introduces his girlfriend, then I'll meet that woman, I'll be nice to her. But if he introduces his wife, then suddenly that carries an importance, and I want to make sure I get to know that person that he's married to, because just the word wife carries with it such important significance. And the first time I could look at Sarah and legally call her my wife was amazing.
Mm.
This is Sarah. 20 years ago, I was working for Ann Richards doing
energy policy here in Texas. And we have, like many states, we have rural electric cooperatives who provide electricity to less populous parts of the state. And there was a gentleman there who was a manager of a co-op in East Texas, and he came up. I had a fairly high profile. He came up to me and said, "I'm a Christian man, and I want to apologize to you." And I said, "Well, what is it, Phil?" He said, "You know, when you were first appointed to this job, I was very, very upset because a lesbian had been appointed to this job." And he said, "You know, I consider myself a Christian man, and now that I have gotten to know you and understand really that you're really no different from me, I basically want to get right with you and get right with my God."
Mm-hmm.
And so here is an example. As those of us that other people don't know and consider the other, as we are able to put a face on our relationship and our lives, I think it really does speak to the hearts of people who consider themselves to be loving, God-fearing people.
Yeah, what a great model and what a great story. I want to go to Thursday the 19th, the day of the wedding. I know things happened very quickly that day, but could you describe how that day unfolded and what it meant to the two of you?
It did all unfold very quickly. It was very surreal and very magic. But it's something that really had started a year ago in February when there was a case before a U.S. district court in San Antonio, and we were all waiting for Judge Garcia to rule on whether or not the ban on gay marriage was constitutional. Sarah and I hoped that that ban would be declared unconstitutional and there would be a window of opportunity where we could get married. So during that time period, while we were anticipating the decision, we had our suits in the car. We had Rabbi Baker at the ready. We were hoping that before there might be a state-imposed stay, we would have the opportunity. So we had people like our wonderful lawyer, Chuck Herring, and friends ready to help us a year ago if the possibility of marriage arose. And so after the probate case that Sarah mentioned, there was another lifting of the ban for a moment, and our lawyer, Chuck Herring, said, "I think this might be the possibility." So literally, it was about 24 hours that we had to think about everything. He filed the legal proceedings. We took our daughters out of school, and our younger daughter said, Mom, I can't miss history class. It's really hard to make up." And we said, "If this happens, you will be making history." So we all went to the clerk's office and waited to see how the judge would rule in our case. And after we got a positive ruling telling the county clerk to issue a marriage license, we were married civilly with that marriage license, and we were also married in the eyes of God by our rabbi.
So when did things start changing?
You know, it really doesn't feel like things have changed. There's something so wonderful about having Rabbi Baker's hands on our heads and him blessing us. And I still feel like that, and of course we have our license.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know there has been, but in sort of in my world, in my personal feelings about this, there really hasn't been a change. What we've experienced is an incredible outpouring of support and love. We even got a card from our mailman.
That's wonderful.
Isn't it? It is, yeah.
Suzanne, you're an attorney. How would you describe what's happened since the wedding on February 19th in legal terms?
Well, you know, I am an attorney, but I'm an adoption attorney. I was born and raised in Texas, but I have practiced law other places, and now the law I know best in Texas is adoption law. So I'm trying not to weigh in too heavily on the legal issues because I am certainly not an expert in these sorts of things. I do feel like, though, that from what I hear from our lawyers and from the overwhelming support we've gotten from other attorneys who are experts in appellate law, experts in civil procedure, it sounds like to me that we are married, our license is valid, and that can't be taken away.
And Sarah, let me ask you the same question, only not the legal dimension, but the personal dimension.
Reverend Gaddy, it's interesting how this has affected our family, and it's affected our family, I think, more profoundly than I imagined. But it's also in subtle ways. When we first started talking about this, our daughter, Ting, our youngest, is almost 14. And she got very excited and started talking about how she wanted to plan our wedding. And we have a dog. And she wanted, the dog to be in the ceremony and be the ring bearer. And she got very excited. We could really see how important it was to them the night of our celebration. Our other daughter is 18, and they put together a slideshow for their moms. It's like, the two best moms in the world. And they had pictures of us as a family. And then that afternoon, they had borrowed a computer and scanned in some earlier pictures of us. And they put this together in a slideshow to share with our friends. And I think things like that really show the pride and happiness that our children also have, because the state now recognizes that their parents are next of kin.
You know, I simply can't come up with an explanation for the kind of action the Attorney General has tried to take, except to say that it's politics. Is it just politics?
Okay, this is fair. I think it's politics. I think it's fear. I'm sure there are people in the country who have, well, it's interesting because you certainly know the Bible better than I do, and we don't stone people anymore. So even fundamentalists have an evolving view of what the Bible suggests is proper, a strong literalist. Mm-hmm. So I think part of it is fear of change. Part of it is, and what I think has helped us so much, is if people don't know or don't know they know an LGBT person, then fears and stereotypes and misinformation flood in. But I think once it's your cousin or nephew or great uncle, then people are able to really manifest the love that I think is how ultimately we've already felt from so many people.
Sure.
I'd like to add to that.
Good.
I do think it's a lot about people being afraid and not embracing change because they're not sure of what's coming. But what we've seen is we have some out in the country, some people we know who are very conservative, and we'll sit on the front porch and talk about that they get their news from Fox News and I get mine from public television and radio. And we'll have some really good debates. Mm-hmm. And, we've gotten congratulatory cards and calls and emails from some pretty darn conservative people who know us and know our family. And that's why we're willing to put our family out as the face of thousands of Texas families like ours.
Yeah.
This is, sir, I just want to say another. I think the fear is also on the part of the politicians.
Yes.
Here in Texas, we have the kind of redistricting where if you are a Republican but attempt to be a moderate Republican, the primaries are often where who's going to be elected is decided.
Uh-huh.
And so, as you know, there aren't a lot of primary voters. And so sometimes the extreme wing of the Republican Party is able to really put fear into some of our politicians, and it forces them to take very extreme positions.
Has either of you or have both of you spoken to Ken Paxton?
No, we have not personally spoken to Ken Paxton.
If you had a chance to speak to him, what would you say to him about your own family and about other same-gender couples across the state?
I know this morning I was really thinking in my heart about him and trying not to be angry or think of him as the other, but to think that he is doing what he thinks is right.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be he thinks it's right for political reasons. It may be that he thinks it's right personally. But I want to believe that he is following what he believes his conscience or his politics expect of him. And I guess I would say to him, we're all in this together, and, we're not that different from you. This is Sarah, and I think I would ask him, we have a strong tradition here in Texas of personal freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the freedom to marry someone that you've been in a long-term committed relationship can be one of our cherished freedoms, mm-hmm. and that's a Texas value. And I think privacy, or sometimes as I call it, mind your own businessness, is also a Texas value. Mm-hmm. And I think that I would ask him to, even though he might be uncomfortable, to get to know some LGBT couples, mm-hmm. because I think he would find then that by having the state support our relationship, by strengthening our family, it really strengthens Texas to strengthen all Texas families.
Isn't that the truth? I know there's an attempt underway to defund any probate judges who grant marriage licenses to same-sex couples. What are tactics are you on the lookout for, and what are the options going forward?
You know, I think that there are some pretty extreme bills out there, things like that, or that only the Texas Secretary of State can issue marriage licenses. And, you know, they're just not practical. And I don't think anybody in Texas is going to think they are. I think they're reactionary. Mm-hmm. And I really would be surprised to see them get much traction in the Texas legislature.
Yeah. Are you feeling the support of the faith community in supporting you all and also in moving equality forward for LGBT people?
Yes. Yes, we are. Yes, we are. And a lot of, like the gentleman that I told you about so many years ago, I welcome a dialogue within the faith community, between faith leaders, because, you know, we really, like, there's the Human Rights Campaign, one of their mottos is love conquers hate. Mm-hmm. And I really believe that that is true and that is happening. You know, it may happen more slowly in some faith communities, but I really do think that the more you get to know someone as an individual, it's harder to hate them. It's easier to see the common humanity that we have and that we're so much more alike than we are different. Mm-hmm. And so I really feel like, you know, here in Texas, the faith community is not letting more radical elements take the banner as being religious, as being devout, that, in fact, the pluralism of the faith community is definitely showing itself.
Oh, I'm so glad. You know, I so many thoughts are running through my mind because talking with you all is such a great pleasure and such an inspiration. Through all of this, you have each other. You've had each other for 30 years, but now you have each other in a very special way. And I only can wish you good health and many more happy years together. I do have to ask you, because your attitudes are so incredibly positive, what is it that keeps you going in this? Where do you find your hope?
I'll address that. When I was in law school, a civil rights activist came and signed his book and said, "Suzanne, immerse yourself in the agonies of your time." And that has been a guiding principle of my life ever since. And I really think right now climate change is the biggest issue of our time. But I think that this is also, gay marriage is also a big issue. And this is where my opportunity has come. You know, we didn't necessarily seek that we would be the people who fell into this role, but it was there and we were willing to step up. And I'm just grateful that we have the opportunity, because not everybody gets an opportunity to feel like they're helping progress in their culture in the same big way that we are.
And this is Sarah, and you know, it sounds trite to say there's always a silver lining in terms of something that appears to be an illness or a burden to bear. But I think not only the cancer, but as I've grown older, I think that the opportunity to ask people to confront their unconscious beliefs. I watched a program a couple days ago about African Americans in the South, and mm-hmm. how even though we've passed civil rights laws and We all believe in equality of opportunity and liberty and the pursuit of happiness that, you know, for many African Americans today and for other groups, their lived experience is so far from our ideals. And I think as people become, all of us become more conscious of our we bring our unconscious biases to consciousness. Mm-hmm. We try affirmatively to question and look inside, that kind of thing can be so transformative for so many people. And I think I have faith that people have the courage to do this.
Sarah Goodfriend and Suzanne Bryant, two amazing people, remarkable. They became the first same-gender couple to marry in the state of Texas on February 19th. This historical moment has been marred by relentless efforts among state officials to nullify their union and throw up every roadblock possible for other same-gender couples. Sarah and Suzanne, I know the last thing you probably want to be doing right now is radio interviews, but I have to tell you, I think your story is essential for our listeners to hear and to absorb, and I know you believe that too. I just can't thank you enough for being with us today on State of Belief Radio and not only educating us, but inspiring us religiously and politically.
Thank you, Reverend Gaddy. Thank you so much.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Can you believe these stories? The ongoing financial support of State of Belief listeners is essential to keeping this show on the air, these kinds of interviews, so you can hear them. I want to thank you if you've made a donation this week. If you find value in what we're doing, I urge you to join our other generous supporters today. Please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can sign up for our free weekly podcast. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/stateofbelief. And look, you can share these stories that you find compelling with your friends. We'd love for you to help us get word around about these interviews and this show. We're also at twitter.com/stateofbelief. Look, this is not a time that we can take anything for granted. If you find value in what you hear, please spread the word. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.